My name is Edward Greenspan. In this week's episode of The Scales of Justice, we look at one of Canada's most notorious murder cases, the trial of Arthur Kendall for the killing of his wife. Coming up next on Stereo Theater, right after the news.
Disagreement over what really happened when Finnish soldiers were kidnapped in Lebanon. I'm Chris Skeen with the CBC News. Israel's Defense Minister Yitzhak Rabin is accusing the United Nations forces in Lebanon of causing this weekend's kidnapping incident. More than 20 UN soldiers from Finland and one French officer were seized by the South Lebanon Army, backed by Israel. Frenchmen and a few Finns are now free, but the standoff continues. The SLA says it won't free the rest of the Finns until the Shiites return 11 of its soldiers. Donald Fields has this report on the reaction in Finland.
Never before in 29 successful years of peacekeeping for the UN have the Finns been accused of bias in this way. The head of Finland's UN Bureau, Major General Petti Jokinen, does not want to comment on Mr. Rabin's allegations. But he assured me that Finnish troops acted within their mandate when they picked up 11 members of the Israeli-backed South Lebanon Army, the SLA, all of whom they considered to be deserters. The 11 are now entire in the hands of the Shiite Amal faction. The Finns transported them part of the way, dropping them, as General Jokinen put it, without fear of being turned over to anybody. After that, 24 Finns were seized by the SLA, only three of whom have been released. Now, Finland is distressed at the prolongation of the crisis and at the impression given by Israel that it acted below its own high standards in this politically fraught affair. But its foreign minister, Mr. Paavo Väyrynen, does not believe the time has yet come for the Security Council to debate the matter. For CBC News, this is Donald Fields in Helsinki.
After struggling with a lung ailment for 19 days, the weakest of the surviving Frustasi septuplets has died. Hospital officials in Orange, California say Bonnie Marie Frustasi died this afternoon in the arms of her parents. She's survived by a sister and two brothers who are showing signs of improvement. All seven of the infants were extremely weak when they were born prematurely on May 21st. One child was stillborn, and three others, including Bonnie Marie, have died from complications. The Prime Minister says that once the next election in Quebec is over, he will personally get involved in building a Conservative Party in the province. Earlier this year, a Quebec Tory party was formed. Its leader finished a strong second in provincial by-elections last week, but Mr. Mulroney has dismissed it, saying the party is premature and was set up without any consultation with the federal Conservatives. The Conservative premiers of the three maritime provinces begin a two-day meeting in Prince Edward Island tomorrow, and there are signs the leaders are not happy with the Conservatives in Ottawa. Premier Hatfield of New Brunswick says he's concerned the federal government is not strongly committed to the Atlantic provinces. He says the Maritimes must be given special considerations if there's to be a full economic recovery across the country. The recent federal budget included plans to chop annual transfer payments to all of the provinces by $2 billion in 5 years. Unusual convocation ceremonies were held at the University of Ottawa today. As about 700 graduates looked on, Maurice Sauvé, the husband of Governor-General Jean Sauvé, was installed as the university's new chancellor. Then, following the presentation of degrees to the graduates, Mr. Sauvé presented his first honorary doctorate to his wife, Michael McAuliffe reports.
The fact that the Governor-General is a former student at the University of Ottawa made her receiving an honorary doctorate even more appropriate. And everyone seemed to agree that there was no one better suited for the job of presenting the degree than Madame Sauvé's husband, Maurice, who was sworn in this morning as the university's new chancellor. The Governor-General says she's especially pleased to have been able to receive the degree from him.
And the circumstances were rather fun, to think that my husband was made the chancellor and then he would turn around immediately and give me a doctorate. Maybe I had a privileged position, didn't I?
It's convocation time at universities throughout Canada right now, and Madame Sauvé offered some advice for graduates. She encourages them to find work they're interested in, and she says it should match their university training. But if they find themselves without jobs, she says they should not fear being innovative or entrepreneurial and trying to open their own businesses. However, Mr. Sauvé said he got the impression from many of the graduates that they already had jobs. Michael McAuliffe, CBC News, Ottawa.
And that's the CBC News. The Metro Toronto weather forecast, clearing this evening with strong westerly winds gusting to 60 kilometers per hour. Clear tonight with brisk westerly winds persisting with a low near 12 overnight. Monday sunny with cloudy periods, continuing windy, not as warm, with a high near 21. The chance of rain is 10% tonight, 20% for Monday. The outlook for Tuesday, sunny with cloudy periods. It's 25 degrees. The time is 5 past 7. This is CBC Stereo, serving Toronto and Peterborough.
Stereo Theater presents The Scales of Justice.
Stop flashing, Jimmy, or I'll tell Mom. I'm not kidding, I'll tell her. Jimmy!
Oh, don't be such a sissy. Mom's busy with Jean and the baby.
Come on, you guys, quit fighting. You better get back to the cabin and give Mom a hand. It's getting close to supper time.
Oh, do we have to? This is so much fun. I could stay here forever.
Margaret is right. We better get back. Last one back in the cabin is a rotten egg.
Stop it.
The happy children of Arthur and Helen Kendall returned to the cabin at Johnston Harbor. The Kendall family was spending the summer of 1952 in the 12-by-14-foot cabin while Arthur worked in the lumber mill across the road. The Kendalls shared their cramped living quarters with Gordon Niebel and George Hislop, two men Arthur had brought with him to help at the mill. Despite the crowded living conditions, the Kendall family was enjoying a carefree summer 90 miles away from their farm in southern Ontario. That is, until the night of August the 2nd, 1952, when Helen Kendall, exemplary wife and mother, mysteriously disappeared. My name is Edward Greenspan, and the story you are about to hear is reconstructed from the trial transcripts of the Supreme Court of Ontario and the documents filed in the Ontario Court of Appeal.
The Scales of Justice, a series recreating real events in Canadian crime, with commentary by the Toronto lawyer, Edward L. Greenspan, QC. In this episode, you will hear Ken James as Arthur Kendall and Frank Perry as Crown Attorney Campbell Grant in the true story of Family Trouble, written by Max and Marilyn Haynes and produced by George Jonas.
It had been the end of May 1952, when Arthur Kendall returned to his farm in Moncton, Ontario, from a fishing trip to the Bruce Peninsula. He had exciting news to tell his family.
Helen, I met a man named Pedwell up in the Bruce Peninsula.
Oh, yeah?
He owns a sawmill, wants me to work there for the summer.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a real good chance to make some extra cash. Well, God knows we can use it.
Yeah, well, what about the farm, Arthur?
Well, the flax is in.
Does that mean you'll be gone the whole summer?
Well, I told Pedwell I had to be back in September for the harvest, and that seemed to be okay with him.
When would you go?
He wants me right away. I'll leave in a day or so. There's a little cabin right across from the mill where I can stay.
Oh, the kids will sure miss you.
He wants me to bring up anyone I can find to help out. I was thinking about asking Jim Bailey, maybe Gordon Ebel and George Hislop. We can all stay in the cabin.
Well, you know, the kids will be out of school all summer.
Yeah, but I can't afford to pass up the chance to make the extra money. Maybe you and the kids will be able to join me later.
And did you hear the news? Dad wants us all to come join him in a cabin for the summer. It'll be great.
All of us, kids?
Sure, you, me, Jimmy, Jean, and the baby.
Yeah, I can't wait. There's a lake up there. We can go swimming anytime we want. A whole summer in the woods.
Will the big black bears eat us up?
Don't be silly, Jean. Dad'll be there. Besides, he's got two other men working with him. No bear's gonna come near our cabin.
Helen Kendall and her five children arrived at the cabin in the Bruce Peninsula around the beginning of July. The eldest and only boy, Jimmy, was 12 years old. Margaret, Ann, and Jean were 10, 8, and 5, respectively. The baby, Mary, was 18 months old. Sleeping accommodations were crowded, considering that the Kendalls were sharing the cabin with Gordon Ebel and George Hislop. By the time Helen and the children arrived, Jim Bailey had already returned to his home.
Arthur.
Oh.
Look, I don't want to complain, but Aren't you taking Mr. Pedwell to the doctors in Wyarton an awful lot? It seems to me every time I turn around, you're dashing off to Wyarton.
I can't very well refuse him a lift. He's my boss. Besides, I don't mind doing an old man a favor once in a while.
Well, what's the matter with him? Is he very sick?
Oh, gee, Helen, he doesn't tell me much. Just that he's feeling poorly.
Well, you should speak up. It isn't fair to the kids. You're working all day at the mill and driving Mr. Pedwell to the doctor's at night.
It isn't only the doctor's office. I got to pick up parts for the sawmill when the damn thing breaks down.
Well, doesn't seem fair.
Look, Helen, I'm doing my best. Well, it really is a lively bunch here tonight, Beatrice.
You know very well, I don't care who's here, Art, as long as I'm with you.
Am I crazy about you, Beatrice?
What?
I'm crazy about you, Beatrice.
Unknown to Helen Kendall, Arthur had taken up with Beatrice Hogue, a waitress employed at the Olympia restaurant in Wyarton. He was not driving Mr. Pedwell to the doctor. He was meeting Beatrice and pretending to be a widower. Beatrice was the wife of Thomas Hogue, a sailor on the Great Lakes. She was living in Wyarton with 5 of her 7 children.
I wish it could always be like this. Just you and me.
Yeah, you and me and a pack of kids. But seriously, Art, could it happen? Could it be forever and ever? I take care of your kids as if they were my own. Those things, being brought up without a mother.
Well, you're right, Beatrice. It's been hard on me since your mother died. I never thought I could love another woman, but... Beatrice, you're my whole life now.
Hold me tight. You kiss me hard, Arthur Kendall.
On July 26, 1952, the 2 men sharing the cabin with the Kendalls left.
I hate to leave you on your own, Art, but a hand won't wait.
Well, fair enough, boys. You've done good work for me. If everything's in the car, let's go.
Thanks for everything, Mrs. Kendall. I'll miss your meals. You sure are a good cook. Those are 5 swell kids you got there, too.
Oh, thanks, Gord. It was a pleasure having you, boys. You're a good company. Oh. And now you drive careful, Arthur.
All right.
Bye, kids.
Bye, kids.
Good of you to drive us, Art. Must be a 2-hour drive.
Maybe, but where are we going?
Well, boys, a little change of plans. We're stopping here in Wyarton to pick up Beatrice and the kids.
What? Here they are.
Is she already? Are you serious? All of us in this car?
Yeah, that's right. It's a bit of a squeeze. We'll make it. Fire in, everyone.
Okay. Gord, you are crazy.
I'll drop Gordon. Gord's off in their place first, and then I'll think of my car. All right? Hang on. Here we go.
The next morning, Arthur asked his neighbor, Martin Barker, if he would like to hire Beatrice as a housekeeper. Barker replied that she had too many children. He simply wasn't interested. As a result, Arthur turned around and drove Beatrice and her children the 90 miles back to Wyarton.
Art, I'm sorry. I can't help it about the kids. You mad at me?
No, I'm not mad.
Arthur Kendall rejoined his own family in the tiny cabin at Johnston Harbor. But then, about a week later, Arthur, his children, Beatrice and her children returned to the Kendall farm in Moncton.
Oh, how you doing, Broughton?
Yeah, good. What are you doing back so soon, Art? Figured you'd stay up north till school started. Well, I've been keeping an eye on the farm for you. Flax isn't near ready for harvesting yet.
Well, I'm back to stay.
Well, the reason I came over, Art, well, saw this pack of people here. I figured they were strangers.
Oh no. This here's Beatrice Hogue. Those are her kids.
Pleased to meet you, ma'am.
And please make your acquaintance, too. Excuse me a minute. Jean, watch yourself. Get down off that fence.
Hey, Art, where's Helen?
I took off with another man. Skinned right out on me.
No.
Went back to her mother.
James Broughton found Arthur Kendall's actions and behavior very peculiar. He couldn't get it out of his mind. 3 days later, he expressed his suspicions to Farmer Lloyd McCann.
Sure doesn't seem right to me, Lloyd. Helen leaving her kids and all. I tell you, something's fishy over there. You know how the Kendall kids are always happy to see me?
Yeah?
Well, they sure weren't happy to see me when I went over there the other day.
Well, what did Dad have to say?
Well, first off, he said Helen's skinned out on him. Yeah, then he said she was at her mother's. I tell you, I don't know what to think.
Well, then, she must be at her mother's.
It just don't seem right to me.
Why don't you phone Helen's brother, Ross Cameron in Brantford? He'll know where she is.
James Broughton did phone Helen's brother and found that he had no idea of his sister's whereabouts. Ross Cameron was concerned enough to drive to the Kendall farm and ask Arthur face-to-face what had happened to Helen. Kendall did not invite him into his home, as was his usual custom. Instead, he joined Cameron in the latter's car.
I'll get right to the point, Art. Where's Helen?
Look, I feel so bad about the whole thing. I never want to see my car again. I almost drove it into the lake.
But, Art, where is my sister?
She ran off with another man. She lit right out on me.
What the hell do you mean? That doesn't sound like Helen leaving the kids.
I can't talk about it anymore. All I know is that she left me.
Dissatisfied with Kendall's answer that Helen had gone off with another man, Ross Cameron, accompanied by James Broughton, went directly to the Ontario Provincial Police Detachment at Sebringville. After he reported his sister missing, the police started an investigation.
Corporal Black didn't get anywhere questioning Kendall. Still claims he walked out of his cabin. When he returned, his wife was gone.
Put this out on the wire. Helen Robson Kendall, 33, blue eyes, blonde hair, 5'7", weight 132 pounds, attractive. Maybe it'll bring some results. In the meantime, I'm going to talk to those kids.
Now, Jimmy, Margaret, Anne, my name is Inspector Leonard Neal. Now, I want you to tell me in your own words what happened in the cabin at Johnston Harbor the night your mom disappeared. Come on, don't be afraid. Just tell me the truth, okay? What happened?
Well, we went up to Johnston Harbor after school was out. All us kids were excited about going. That's all we talked about. Swimming, hunting snakes. We couldn't wait to get going.
That's right, Jimmy. We sure were excited.
I think Mom left on Thursday. I think.
It was Thursday, Jimmy.
Yes, Thursday. Mom threw a cup of tea in Dad's face. I don't know why.
Then what happened?
Jimmy went outside.
Yeah, I was scared, I guess.
Dad said he was going to Tobermory for groceries and went outside the cabin.
Go on. What happened then?
Mom gave us our supper. Then she started getting ready and left. She took her nightie and her hat, a black one with a big feather on the side. She put them in a big grocery bag. She put on a dress with red, gray, and yellow in it. She went out the door and said, "I'll never be back."
Jim, did you see your mother leave the cabin?
No, sir. I had walked away after Dad left. When I went back in the cabin, Jean was crying.
Oh, that's your 5-year-old sister?
Yes, sir. Jean was crying and said Mom was gone. Margaret, Anne, and Jean saw her go down the road.
She had on her wedding ring when she left. But a couple of days before, we saw her put her diamond ring on a nail where the second set of car keys are kept. When we left, we forgot the ring, and Mr. Pedwell sent it to us.
Uh-huh. All right, what happened after your mother left that evening?
We all went to bed. We don't know when Dad come home. We saw him in the morning. I asked him when he come home, and he said he come home last night. We told him Mom had gone, and he just looked disgusted. He didn't say anything. He just looked disgusted.
The three eldest Kendall children were questioned on several different occasions. Together or apart, they always told the same story. On September 3, 1952, a month after Helen Kendall disappeared, Farmer John Krugel, a neighbor of Kendall's near Moncton, made a discovery. He was in an area known as Hammond's Bush, located a short distance from the Kendall farm. Krugel left his wife sitting in his car and walked into the woods.
What's this? Cardboard box. It's women's clothes in here. White slips. Say, come on in here.
What for?
Just come on in.
What is it?
What are this stuff I found? There's a couple of women's slips. There's a dress. Yeah, what's this? There's a farmer's advocate. It's addressed to, let me see, Arthur Kendall. Kendall? We better not touch anything else. We're going to the police.
John Krugel did go to the OPP with news of his discovery. Inspector Neal, accompanied by Krugel, recovered the box of clothing from Hammond's Bush. The clothing was identified as belonging to the missing Helen Kendall. While Ontario Provincial Police were pondering this mystery, other events were taking place near the Kendall farm that September of 1952. One night, a man named Elwood Stephen was driving his bike towards his home along a darkened country road near Hammond's Bush. According to Stephen, he saw a man walking along the road ahead of him. Then he saw the man, for no apparent reason, jump off the road and into the ditch. By the time Stephen caught up to him, the man was walking along the road again.
Hey there. Mind if I walk along with you for a bit?
Hey, you live up here?
Yep. Name's Stevens. What's your name?
Kendall.
Oh. I was just riding to my home up here from my neighbors. Sure got dark in a hurry, didn't I?
Yeah, some fellas gave me a lift partway home. I have to walk to Balance.
Let me see. Well, this is my gate. Good night, Kendall.
Good night.
Strange man.
Stephen was never able to date this encounter as having been before or after the discovery of the box of clothing in Hammond's Bush. But another incident the next day did seem to tie it in more closely.
Hey, Gord. The kids sure enjoyed the fall fair. No, thanks for taking the whole gang. Must have had your hands full, eh? Well, it gave Beatrice me a chance to enjoy ourselves.
Oh, don't mention it. I think your kids are great.
Gord, can I ask another favor of you?
Sure. What's on your mind?
Well, I'll tell you. I was walking near Hammond's Bush last night, and I found something. And I threw it in a ditch. Some guy on a bicycle came along, and I threw it away.
No problem, Art. Let's take a spin over there now.
Great.
Where do you want me to stop?
Go slow. Better still, I'll get out on the running board. Go slow now.
Hey, what's the big mystery? What is it you're looking for?
There it is.
For Christ's sake, a shovel?
The following spring, OPP officers learned of Gord Niebel's drive to Hammond's Bush, where Arthur Kendall claimed he had found a shovel. It was one more piece of information, but it led them nowhere. Months drifted into years. Beatrice's husband, Thomas Hogue, obtained a divorce, naming Arthur as correspondent. When 7 years had elapsed since Helen's disappearance, Arthur had her declared legally dead, and he married Beatrice Hogue. 9 years passed. Jimmy, 21 now, still lived at home, as did his two youngest sisters. Margaret, 19, was married and living in Winnipeg. She was the mother of one child and expecting another. 17-year-old Anne had just been ordered to leave the house by her stepmother after the latest of what appears to have been a number of quarrels. And it was Anne who then began the second phase of the Kendall case.
Okay, this is it. Here's the break in the Kendall case.
Kendall? What case is that, sir?
The letter from Anne Kendall. She's finally decided to tell the truth about what happened to her mother. I received your letter, Anne.
I couldn't keep it a secret any longer. It's been over 9 years, and I think about it all the time. We were all too scared to tell the truth.
What really happened that night, Anne?
I saw it. I saw my father dragging my mother from the cabin. I saw blood, I saw the knife. Margaret and Jimmy and myself, we all saw it.
Hello.
Hello, Margaret. This is Anne.
Anne, it's nice to hear from you.
How are you doing?
I'm fine. We're all fine.
Good. I have something to tell you. I've had a long talk with Inspector Graham of the Ontario Provincial Police. I told him the truth about what happened to Mother.
Oh, God.
It's time, Margaret. I couldn't stand it any longer. Will you tell them the truth, too?
Yes, Anne, I will.
Inspector Graham flew to Winnipeg to speak to Margaret. As a result of his interview with Margaret Kendall Bell, Arthur Kendall was arrested and charged with the murder of his wife, Helen Robson Kendall. His murder trial began on October 23, 1961, in Walkerton, Ontario. It was unusual in many ways. As Crown Attorney Campbell Grant rose to make his opening remarks, the very atmosphere of the courtroom was heavy, with one undeniable fact. Helen Kendall's body had never been found.
May it please your lordship and gentlemen of the jury. Because this is a charge of capital murder, it is the obligation of the Crown to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the murder was planned and deliberate. It is also the duty of the Crown to convince you with proper evidence beyond a reasonable doubt, first, that this woman is dead, and that she was murdered, and that this accused did it. The finding of a body is not necessary. I would now like to call Margaret Bell.
The first of the Kendall children took the witness stand. She now told quite a different story from the one she had related 9 years before.
Mrs. Bell, what was the relationship that existed between your mother, father, and you five children?
We were all very close. We loved each other. There were no arguments in our home at all.
How did your father bring up you children?
To respect him wholly. When we were told to do something, we did it. If we didn't do it, well, we were punished for it, to teach us not to do it again.
Did anything unusual happen in the summer of 1952?
We all went to live in a cabin at Johnston Harbor. Dad worked in Mr. Pedwell's sawmill right across the road from the cabin.
Mm-hmm. When did you last see your mother?
The last day my father worked at the mill, early Saturday morning.
Where had you been sleeping, Margaret?
In the top bunk in the cabin with my sister Anne. My father and mother slept in the bunk below. Jimmy was in the bottom bunk across, and little Jean was in the top bunk across.
What made you wake up so early that morning?
There was a commotion. We heard noises.
Don't hurt!
According to Margaret, she saw her father open the door and dragged the limp body of her mother down the road.
What is it?
Shh. Shh, Anne. Don't make a sound. Oh, my God. Look at the blood on the floor. Dad's gone. Mom must be hurt. Shh. Don't make a sound. Washing the blood off the floor.
Come on, kids. Get up and get dressed.
Here, Mary, let me dress you.
Now listen carefully and listen good. If anyone ever asks you children, this is what you tell them. Your mother and I had an argument. No. A fight. She threw a cup full of hot tea at me, and I walked out. Then she changed her clothes and left the cabin.
But Dad...
Don't dad me. Your mother said she'd never come back. Now, remember that. Never come back.
Where is Mom?
She's gone, that's all. I'll never ask again.
Will Mom get better? Is she in the hospital?
Don't you kids understand English? Your mother left and said she'd never come back. I don't want to hear any more about it. You understand?
But who'll take care of us?
Let me worry about that. You just remember what I said. If any one of you ever tells a different story, I'll thrash you within an inch of your life.
Margaret, why didn't you speak up since that day?
If Dad told me to say anything, I was to say it.
Did you children discuss what had happened to your mother at breakfast?
We thought Dad may have taken her to a hospital, that's all.
Well, then what happened?
Anne and I picked berries for lunch. We killed a rattlesnake, too. Later, we all drove to Wyarton. And on the way, we gathered a trunk full of firewood and took it to Beatrice Hogue's house.
Did you know Beatrice Hogue?
No.
How long did you stay there at Beatrice Hogue's house?
3 or 4 days. Then we went back to our farm in Moncton.
Arthur Kendall's lawyer, M.A. Craig, cross-examined.
On the morning after your mother disappeared, did your father go to work?
Yes, sir.
And what did you do then?
We ate breakfast, us five kids. Then my sister Anne and I went along the Johnston Harbor Road picking berries.
And while you were picking berries, did you have any discussion about what happened to your mother?
No, sir.
Have you ever talked to your sister Anne about this matter?
No, sir.
Have you ever talked to your brother Jimmy about this matter?
No, sir.
Well, I suggest that on the morning after your mother's disappearance, you did talk to your sister Anne and your brother Jimmy about your mother's disappearance.
No, he didn't.
Well, Mrs. Bell, at the preliminary hearing, if I may quote you, you said in part, "We thought she was in hospital. We discussed it among ourselves." Did you say those words?
Yes, sir. What we never discussed is the part about my father taking my mother out of the cabin.
Mr. Craig had established that there was some doubt in the children's minds directly after the disappearance of their mother as to her fate. If the children had a doubt, he would later argue, so too must the jury, because, of course, there was no body. He continued his cross-examination, making the obvious and essential point.
Did you tell police officers in 1952 that your mother just walked out?
Yes, sir.
And the only reason you told the police officers that is because your dad told you to tell it? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, he told me to say that, and that's what I told them.
What did your sister Anne say to you on the phone when she called you in Winnipeg concerning this matter?
She told me that she had told the truth. And would I tell the truth? And I told her yes.
The Crown next called Anne Kendall to the stand. Anne was only 8 at the time of her mother's disappearance.
Now, Miss Kendall, what was your relationship to your father in 1952?
Dad was always real strict, but he was a very good father to us, and I loved him as much as my mother.
After you came from Johnston Harbor, what about your father's disposition then?
He was still strict. I was always afraid of him because of what he had done to Mother.
What happened on the morning of your father's last day at Pedwell's Mill?
I woke up real early. I heard my mother cry, "Arthur, please don't." She was in the lower bunk with my father.
And what did you do when you heard that?
I looked down from my bed, and I saw my father lay a knife on the table with blood on it.
What did your father do next?
He put his arm around my mother's shoulder and dragged her out the door. She was in her nightgown.
When you saw all this, what did you do?
I just lay there. Margaret put her hand over my mouth so I could be quiet.
Did you say anything to your father that day?
No, I was too scared.
Anne had substantially verified her older sister's testimony. Then the Crown Counsel asked the question that was central to the trial.
What you saw that fateful morning of August the 2nd, 1952, what effect did it have on you later in relating to police what you had seen?
I lied.
Why?
Because I was scared of Dad.
And what caused you to tell the police what you now say is the truth?
I've always wanted to find my mother's body and give her a decent burial.
Mr. Craig, acting for Arthur Kendall, had another suggestion to make. He drew forth from Anne admissions designed to support an argument that the children might have a reason to be fabricating evidence.
Miss Kendall, I want to ask you a few questions about your stepmother. I believe you thought she was very unkind to you and the other Kendall children.
Yes.
And that she used vulgar language to you at times?
Yes.
And that you thought she didn't treat you decently. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
And you claim that she treated the Hogue children better than the Kendall children.
Yes, she did.
And for these reasons, over the years, you've come to dislike her immensely.
I mean
I'm talking about your stepmother.
Yes. I don't like her now.
Campbell Grant thought this was important enough to rise in re-examination of his own witness.
Just a moment, Anne. My learned friend just asked you about your feelings toward your stepmother. What was the reason for that?
Pardon?
Why did you develop a dislike for your stepmother?
She used to curse us and not use us like decent people at all. We were not used like children. We were just used like servants or something that was not there. And she was not the least bit nice like my own mother was. And I was not used to having such a disrupt home at all times. I used to be spoken to gently, and when I did things wrong, I was punished for it, and then it was forgotten. And not brought up like my stepmother when I did something wrong. It was brought up in very vulgar ways. And she told me about it for weeks after I did it. And things like that. And it was just that I was not used to such a vulgar manner of a person. I was used to a decent, lovely mother like my own. And she never gave me any reason to like her one little bit. So I don't think I have any right to like her.
After this passionate outburst, it was Jimmy Kendall's turn to take the witness stand.
About a week before the incident with my mother, Dad asked me to go fishing.
And did you go fishing?
No, sir. We went to Beatrice Hogue's house in Wyerton.
Had you ever seen Beatrice Hogue before?
No, sir.
What took place in the Hogue home that night?
We unloaded some wood and went in the house. I saw Mrs. Hogue sitting on my father's lap, and I was pretty upset about it. I saw her give him a couple of kisses. We stayed until midnight and then went back to the cabin at Johnson's Harbor.
Did you tell your mother anything about this?
No, sir. I didn't want to hurt her feelings, sir.
Did you say anything to your father about it?
No, sir. I was brought up to be seen and not heard. What he did was supposed to be right, and I was not to interfere. So I just didn't say anything.
Now, Jimmy, can you tell us what woke you on the last morning you spent in the cabin at Johnston Harbor?
First thing I heard was my mother saying, "Don't, Art." Then I looked down on them and saw my father taking my mother out through the door of the cabin. My father had his arm around her waist, and she looked pretty limp, like she was slumped beside him. Her feet were dragging. I saw them go past the window down the road.
What else did you notice in the room, Jim?
I saw a butcher knife on the table, sir. It had blood on it.
What else did you notice?
I noticed there was a bit of blood on the floor.
What happened then?
My father came back to the cabin. It was within an hour.
Did you say anything?
No, sir. I was too frightened. I was just wondering if he was going to come back and get the rest of us. The next I saw him, he came through the door. He didn't have a shirt on. He had a pair of pants on and a pair of rubber boots.
What were you doing at that time?
I was in my bunk pretending I was sleeping. I saw my dad wipe the blood off the floor and off the knife.
Jimmy went on to relate how he spent the rest of that day. His testimony was consistent with that of his two younger sisters. The entire family had spent the night at Beatrice Hogue's house in Wyerton. The next day...
Jimmy, fetch Russell Hogue and come with me. We're going back to the cabin to get our stuff. Here, give me a hand with this mattress. Yeah, throw me the rope, Jimmy. We'll tie her on top of the car.
Any room for this box?
Squeeze it in, Russell. There, that should do it.
Just a minute, boys. I want to leave Mr. Pedwell a note. Let's see now. Mr. Pedwell. Dear sir, the flax is ready to go. I've had family trouble and have to leave. I simply can't help myself. Yours, Arthur Kendall. That should do it. Just tack this up on the door. Right. Yeah, okay, boys, let's go.
Kendall's lawyer cross-examined his client's son.
When you were being interviewed by police, I suggest that you were aware at all times that the police officers were looking for your mother.
Yes, sir.
And you didn't tell the story at any time that you do now, not even up to the preliminary hearing?
No, sir.
Why didn't you?
For a long time, because I was frightened. That's the main reason.
Was there any other reason?
Around the time of my father's arrest, I wasn't scared for myself anymore. But I was frightened for my two younger sisters still living with my father. Then, when Dad was locked up, I did tell the police that I'd lied back in 1952. But it wasn't until the time of the preliminary hearing that I gave the police a true statement of that last night at Johnson's Harbor.
So, you didn't tell the police officers at any time that your father was guilty of any foul play until the preliminary hearing?
That's right, sir.
The Crown Attorney wasn't finished. He wanted to establish a strong motive for the killing. By his children's own admission, Arthur had been a loving father and husband for years, right up until that summer of 1952. But according to them, all that changed when he met Beatrice Hogue.
Gordon Nebel, you were working at Pedwell's sawmill with Arthur Kendall for a short period of time during the summer of 1952?
Yes, sir.
Where did you live?
At Johnson Harbor, in a cabin across from the sawmill. First, there was Jim Bailey, Art Kendall, George Hislop, and myself. We all chipped in, batched it.
Mm-hmm. What did you do for recreation?
Well, we'd go to Wyarton or Tobermory in Art's car. One night, we went to this restaurant in Wyarton, the four of us.
Hey, Art!
Oh, hi. Hey. Come on up here. Boys, I want you to meet a friend of mine. Beatrice Hogue.
How you doing?
Hi.
Beatrice, these are the guys who work with me. This is Gord.
All right.
Jim. George.
Glad to meet you, boys. This here is Joyce, and this is Nelda.
Hi. How are you? Nelda.
Now, we're all excited about going to this dance.
Right, well, then, what are we waiting for, huh?
I don't know. Will you boys pardon us when we visit the little girls for us? Oh,
okay. Yeah, well, take your time, eh?
Okay.
Ooh, hey, well, boys, hey, listen. Hey, what do you think of Beatrice?
Hey, not bad, eh?
Not bad.
That lady really knows how to do it.
I should know, eh? We've done it seven different ways.
Oh, now, look at
you. Best lay I've ever had.
The Crown had established that Arthur Kendall was on intimate terms with Beatrice Hogue. No evidence was ever led that Beatrice knew that Helen Kendall was alive. Gordon Nebel also gave evidence on another issue, that although admissible, may well have inflamed the minds of the jurors against Arthur Kendall.
It was either December 1952 or January 1953, I don't remember. Irene Hogue and Margaret Kendall came into our barn. Arthur came in shortly thereafter. For no reason I could figure, he whipped Margaret with a horse whip. One of the awfulest whippings ever a man could give a kid.
In general, the Crown cannot lead evidence of the accused's bad character. It is irrelevant and prejudicial. In this case, it was apparently admissible to support the children's claim about their fear of their father as the reason for not going to the authorities. On cross-examination, though, Kendall's lawyer forced Nebel to admit that the whipping was related to Nebel's being alone in the barn with 11-year-old Margaret and Beatrice's 14-year-old daughter. Nebel conceded that he had been engaged in banter about castrating bulls with the two young girls. As a result, Kendall's behavior seemed more understandable. Nonetheless, it emerged that on January the 7th, 1953, a Dr. C.E. Connors filed a report that Kendall had attacked his daughter with a whip. Although he was later acquitted on a charge of assault, the Children's Aid Society used the whipping as the key to a successful application for custody of the three elder Kendall children. Kendall appealed this action, and a year later, the children were returned to their father. Interestingly, on their own evidence, they did not discuss their mother's disappearance among themselves or with anyone else, even during this year when they were under the Children's Aid Society's protection. It was only 9 years later that Anne, having had a quarrel with Beatrice Hogue and having been told to leave the house, finally told her new story of events in 1952. The Crown closed his case. No evidence at all was called for the defense, and in a moment I will discuss that. The law in Canada is clear that when the defense calls no evidence, the prosecution addresses the jury first. And so Campbell Grant rose to his feet.
Firstly, it has been established that Helen Kendall was a most devoted mother, and that no family could have been brought up better than her children. Now, once Arthur Kendall came to the Bruce Peninsula in May of 1952, he began an improper relationship with Beatrice Hogue while posing as a widower. He even took Beatrice to his own home in Moncton in the absence of his wife. He attempted to get her a job as a housekeeper with his neighbor, but failed. You have heard of the crime from the children who have kept their terrible secret for 9 years. You've heard them reveal how they were under their father's domination, then lied when questioned by the police in 1952, saying that their mother left the cabin of her own volition. Can any reasonable person believe that a woman who loved her children as Helen Kendall did would walk away, never to be in touch with them again? Would she walk 4.5 miles through rattlesnake-infested country? Isn't it more reasonable to believe 3 eyewitnesses who are now young adults? You might ask, why did Anne Kendall come forward at such a late date? Her answer is an honest one. She wanted to find her mother's body so that she might be given a proper burial. You might also ask, where is the body? Those children heard their mother say, "Don't, Arthur." Saw the bloody knife. Saw the blood on the floor. Saw the bedclothes taken away. Saw the woman dragged out of the cabin limp. Isn't that proof of death? Isn't that the body?
Because he had not called evidence, Kendall's lawyer was entitled to address the jury last. Some counsel see this as an extremely important advantage and may elect to call no evidence because of that reason alone. We'll never know exactly why Craig called no evidence. He may have thought his cross-examinations had exposed enough weaknesses in the children's evidence to raise a doubt in the minds of the jury. He may have worried about subjecting his client to the cross-examining expertise of Campbell Grant. In any case, the only voice heard in Arthur Kendall's defense at trial was that of his lawyer.
I submit to you, gentlemen of the jury, that if Arthur Kendall planned to kill his wife, he could find 100 better places where he could carry out such a plan than in a 12-by-14-foot cabin in the presence of his 5 children. The Crown has not proved any guilt of any kind beyond a reasonable doubt. One of the children expressed the opinion that they thought their mother was in a hospital. If the children had a doubt as to whether their mother was dead or alive, then you gentlemen must have doubts as to whether Helen Kendall is dead or alive. And this brings me to my second main point. I suggest, gentlemen, that the evidence of the key witnesses for the Crown, that is, the children, is improbable, it is inconsistent, it is so unsatisfactory that it should not be accepted in a case of this kind. I suggest that when you examine what Margaret said in 1952, you will conclude that her father couldn't have told her to say all the things she did say. But she talked about her mother packing a nightie when she left. She talked about a black hat with a feather, about her mother putting on a red, gray, and yellow dress. She said her mother wore her wedding ring, but had taken off her diamond ring. This is a 10-year-old child, gentlemen, giving a statement in considerable detail. And then we have Ann Kendall's evidence. How she had come to dislike her stepmother so much that she treated the Hogue children better than the Kendall children, and that her father sided with her stepmother in any of their disagreements. It is impossible to overestimate the scorn and hatred that there was between Anne and her stepmother. I'm not suggesting it was not justified. I'm not suggesting either way. But it is under these circumstances that we have Anne Kendall bringing this matter to the attention of the police. Gentlemen, I'd like you to consider this. Even if you are inclined to accept the evidence of these children, because of the lapse of time and these other circumstances I have mentioned, it would not be safe to convict a man of murder on evidence of this kind.
The Crown and the defense had concluded their summations. It was now left to Mr. Justice Parker to charge the jury.
Now this is the time to discuss with you the commonly held theory that you cannot convict for murder unless the body is found. May I say to you now that there is no such theory in law. If the Crown proves that Helen Kendall is dead, that the accused killed her, and that he intended to kill her, then he is guilty of non-capital murder. But if the Crown in addition satisfies you that the murder is planned and deliberate, then the accused is guilty of capital murder.
The jury retired to consider their verdict. In just a little over 2 hours, they returned.
Bring in the prisoner. Very well. Bring in the jury.
Gentlemen of the jury, have you agreed upon your verdict? Do you find the prisoner at the bar guilty or not guilty?
Guilty as charged.
It's not right. It's not right.
The Crown moves for judgment, my lord.
Stand up, Arthur Kendall. You have been found guilty of capital murder. The sentence of the court upon you, Arthur Kendall, for the crime for which you have been found guilty, is that you be taken from the place where you now are to the place from whence you came, there to be kept in close custody until the 23rd day of January 1962, when you will be taken forth to the place of execution and hanged by the neck until you are dead. And may God have mercy on your soul. Remove the prisoner.
Arthur Kendall appealed his conviction to the Ontario Court of Appeal. The appeal was dismissed with very brief reasons. Kendall's new lawyer, Charles Dubin, then took the case to the Supreme Court of Canada, and in that forum, he argued the central legal issue of the trial.
My lords, it is submitted that the very foundation of the Crown's case was the evidence given by the children of the accused, and the Crown relied very heavily, if not exclusively, on that evidence. The case, my lords, is unique in that the children were testifying in 1961 as to events allegedly observed by them in 1952, at a time when they were 8, 10, and 12 years old, respectively. What they recounted in court as adults is what they had observed when they were children of tender years. Accordingly, it is my respectful submission that their evidence required special instruction and consideration in the learned trial judge's charge to the jury, since such evidence has many testimonial frailties. Let me point out with the utmost respect that the evidence of Anne Kendall was clearly the most damaging evidence given by the children, and, my lords, at the time of the events which she was relating, Anne Kendall was a child of 8 years of age. If she had been giving evidence in a court of law in 1952, the first duty of the trial judge would have been to determine if she knew the nature of an oath, if she could be sworn as a witness. It is respectfully submitted that the probative value of her evidence cannot be improved by the passage of 9 years.
William Bowman, arguing for the Crown, saw the matter quite differently.
My lords, it is the Crown's contention that with respect to the evidence of the children,
The question to be decided was whether they could accurately describe what they had seen and heard 9 years before, when they were youngsters. My lords, this is not a case where a witness is suddenly called upon to recall some ordinary event. The event here would be burned into their memories. There are no doubt cases where the circumstances indicate that the probability of accurate recollection is not strong, and where, consequently, the trial judge should caution the jury. But it is submitted that this is not one of them. In this particular case, I suggest, the children would have difficulty in forgetting, rather than remembering, the scene they describe.
The Honorable Mr. Justice Judson delivered the unanimous opinion of the Supreme Court of Canada on March 26, 1962.
The contradiction between what the children said in 1952 and what they said in 1961 raised a serious question of credibility. This was clearly and adequately put to the jury on evidence that the children were under fear and intimidation. There could be no attack on the judge's charge on this ground. The substantial attack was that the judge failed in his duty to warn the jury as to the care with which the children's evidence should be received. The argument is that the evidence in 1961 suffers from the same frailty it would have had in 1952 when the Kendall children were of tender years, and that it cannot be any stronger in 1961 than it would have been in 1952. I do not agree. When these children gave evidence, they were 21, 19, and 17 years of age. They were in the same position at that age as any other witness. They were not testifying to a routine matter that happened 9 years before. If they were telling the truth, what they had seen must have made an indelible impression on their minds at the time, and must have been something that they could never forget. There was no error on the part of the trial judge with respect to his charge to the jury, and accordingly, I would dismiss the appeal.
5 days before he was to be executed, Arthur Kendall's sentence was commuted to life imprisonment. He served a total of 16 years in prison before being paroled in 1977. Today, Arthur Kendall lives in retirement with his wife, the former Beatrice Hoag in British Columbia, and still maintains his innocence.
You have heard the true story of Family Trouble, an episode in our series, The Scales of Justice, recreating real events in Canadian crime. The script was by Max and Marilyn Haynes, and the commentary by the Toronto lawyer, Edward L. Greenspan, QC. In the cast, you have heard Ken James as Arthur Kendall, Paul Soles as his lawyer M.A. Craig, and Frank Perry as Campbell Grant, counsel for the Crown. Jimmy, Margaret, and Ann Kendall as youngsters were played by Brian Stittle, Karam Malachi Sanchez, and Chance Drury, and as adults by Grant Buchanan, Nikki Guadagni, and Terry Hawks. You have also heard David Calderisi, Roger Dunn, Barry Flatman, Susan Hogan, Jack Mather, Ken Pogue, Angela Rizakos, Wayne Robson, Jack Scott, Cedric Smith, Michael Tate, and Hugh Webster. Elva Mae Hoover was heard as Mrs. Kendall. Technical operations were by Derek Stubbs, with sound effects by Stephanie McKenna. The production assistant was Nina Callahan. The music consultant, Stephanie McKenna. And the casting director, Anne Weldon Tate, with the assistance of Catherine Kester. The associate producer is Guy Gavriel Kay. The Scales of Justice is produced in Toronto by George Jonas. This is Fred Napoli speaking. Next week, British Columbia author-lawyer William Devereaux dramatizes and stars in one of his own cases, the trial of 17 marijuana smugglers from Newfoundland. The role of ringleader Gary Sexton is recreated by Gary Sexton himself on The Scales of Justice.